content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we start today's session with a new chapter, and this is called Youth, and it's for May and June. And our first headline here is A Season for Sisterhood, and this is just a little about her personal information before we get into the vegetables and planting. We have found neutral ground, my sister and I. After 3.5 decades, there is at last a place for us to be at peace. A new mother tongue that does not have so many angry phrases. We talk not of what has been or might have been, had someone or the other done something differently. We speak the language of flowers instead. I have an urgent garden question, is how her phone calls begins these days, and with those words we start rewriting the story of Big Sister, Little Sister, a tale that did not go so well the first time around. No matter that she doesn't always listen, she stored the dormant pot of calla lilies under the kitchen radiator. Not exactly where I recommended, but they bloomed just as well the next year anyhow. Her urgent questions are the opening lines of our revisited first chapter of Growing Up Together, and for that reason I am grateful and not so picky about such details. When we were little and the grandma she is named for grew them, my little sister crinkled her freckled nose and objected loudly to the stink of marigolds. Their gaudy color shone positively gleamed as if grandma had planted them exactly to match the child's orange hair. Young Marion was more inclined to horseplay than horticulture. However, her knees skinned and trousers shredded, not from bending to the task of weeding, but some far more hellish undertaking, decidedly lacking in adult supervision. No time to stop and smell the flowers when you're playing cowboys. Though not her namesake, perhaps they should have called me Lily, as hard as I tried to be demure, I never declined a chance to sit by Grandma Marion while she dried flowers from her garden in an old wooden press. From the lifeless bits she composed, intricate arrangements that she later framed. Pressed flower pictures, we called them, proudly, but I remember that it was my room, not Marion's, whose walls were covered in them. When she was not growing or pressing flowers, Grandma was painting pictures of them, a giant green ceramic vase of lilacs, a bowl of pansies, perhaps, and yes, of course, her precious marigolds. Later, when Grandma was gone and growing pains were being felt full force at my end of the hallway, Marion was the sister who got bouquets from those who wished for her attention. Even then, Marion loved a rose, preferably long-stemmed and by the dozen, but I never actually thought that she would grow one. Apparently, I had something to learn about my sister and about humility. "Are those roses you gave me ramblers?" she asked not long ago, because they had clambered up and over this and that, as rambler roses do. "You know the ones you said were dead." The plants in question had arrived in time for an unseasonably early bout of high heat. Because I was not home, they had sat in their package in the sun right where the UPS man left them. They stayed that way for days, attempting a rescue on my return. I soaked them a while in a bucket of water and cut the cooked parts back, but they were too far gone to my impatient eye to bother with. "I'll take them," said Marion, seeing the dead creatures lying on the lawn one day when she visited, and so she did. Within what seemed like no time, the dead plants had undergone a resurrection and then proceeded quickly to ascend, too. By summer's end, they were well up a trellis where an enthusiastic tangle of vines, probably previous year's casualties from my own garden, already grew lustily as if to get back at me for my rejection. There is a certain hazard to passing on your outcasts, whether to family or to friend. You may very likely have to face the plants again. Do not forget this fact. Some, sent away because they were so aggressive, will quickly overtake their new home as they did your place. This does little to enhance the sense that the spirit of generosity was behind your gift. Other plants were banished because their color proved too jarring. No spot for them could be found, no matter how hard you tried, so out they went too. Such was the case with a dozen peach and melon-colored daylilies, and I was glad to see them go. I was not quite so glad to see them as a focal point at Marion's, where somehow magically they fit right in as if custom ordered for the spot. It is not all having to grit teeth, of course, not all a test of one's semi-good humor. I admit to an intense pleasure when she comes to pick my apples in fall, knowing I will hear about the pies and sauce for months to come. The image of them on her table is a good one, as if the act of sharing a harvest is deeply knit into the gardener's soul. The summer I planted 3 dozen tomato seedlings, her own crop was lost to some animal invasion. No matter, between us there was plenty. Fruits heal all wounds, even those as old as childhood. For now, the phone keeps ringing with the questions, although I suspect she doesn't really need the answers anymore, and could even give a few herself. Admittedly, I will not try storing my callas inside the radiator cover, but there is a certain red poppy in her garden I'd like the name of, or better yet, some of its seeds. We are actually beginning to look more alike as a consequence of this shared passion. They say that family traits are often revealed as the years go by, but that's not it. It's our case. It is the matching scratches on the insides of our forearms I refer to, the marks of rose thorns or the ankle-circled scars from wasp nets run over with the mower. It is the red half circles around each neck where the sun found its way in to sear our skin. Even our gardens have taken on a certain similarity. She, too, plants pumpkins in her flower beds as if this idiosyncrasy were a familiar trait. There is more to this garden stuff than planting. I guess more than the books offer in step-by-step detail. No wonder, then, that the language of gardening and the language of life have so many words in common. Words like tend and cultivate, words like grow. And our first topic for this chapter is nuisance wildlife. Mole or vole, woodchuck, rabbit or deer, who ate or uprooted my plants? By this point, I suspect every gardener has faced at least one fur-bearing opponent, all usually lumped in the general catch-all of nuisance wildlife. Identifying the specific culprit is the critical first step to future prevention or to devising a safe, sane, and humane solution if the unwanted animal is already in residence. With deer, I have already said I am a true believer in fences. With other animals, thanks to a long friendship with my local licensed nuisance wildlife handler, Mike Todd, I have mostly learned to diagnose what animal is to blame and how and when to intervene. Here's how I have been taught to think. When the plant damaged during the night or by day, and in what season? Oh, when was the plant damaged during the night or by day, and in what season? Dug up containers at noon are probably the damn gray squirrels at midnight. More likely, it's raccoons or perhaps a skunk searching for grubs. Did it happen in the growing season or winter? Rabbits and deer are active even in cold months, usually eating woody plants. Woodchucks are hibernating then. Where is the damage located on the plant? Within about 2 feet of the ground, it's probably a rabbit or woodchuck who can't damage branches higher up like a deer can. Sometimes added clues include tracks in the snow or from dew-moistened feet on decks or pavement, or the gift of scat, such as rabbit pellets. What does the damage look like up close? Deer leave jagged edges because they don't have upper teeth, but simply grab the plant between their lower incisors and their upper jaw, then pull and rip it. Rabbits are noted for their very tidy, clean cuts at a 45-degree angle. Again, a reflection of their dentition. Woodchucks, who like rabbits, have upper and lower teeth, are a bit messier, and also, after deer, the most voracious, able to erase quite a swath of vegetable garden growth in pretty short order. Their favorite foods here are brassicas and legumes, and wild violets and asters. If half a row of peas is gone, I know it's no mere rabbit. Any holes or tunneling? Woodchuck holes are large and distinctive, and woodchucks normally forage in early morning and early evening, quite near their burrows, making them relatively easy to trap. If I patiently scour the place, including along the roadside and driveway culverts, I usually find the holes. Then there are much smaller moles and voles, often confused for each other, though their lifestyles are quite different. Moles are fossorial. They live underground and also insectivorous, foraging for insects, grubs, and worms. They may dislodge plants while tunneling, but did not do so to eat them. You might see the occasional volcano-like mounds of soil, the proverbial mole hill, but mostly the tip-off is that the lawn surface feels wobbly like a washboard, and if you step on it, the humps press back down. Voles are rodents and herbivores, plant eaters, including bark of woody things and bulbs and even seeds. And though they are semi-fossorial, with underground runways. What we notice in that their tunneling is at the surface, where they may also eat the turf they displace. A horrifying moment of vole awareness is when the snow melts, revealing mad, squiggly patterns of missing grass. Since they are active all year, and I discover surface runways at other times, too. Was there damage to bark? Bark damage requires another when and where investigation. For example, male deer in what is called rut mating season polish their antlers against trees, especially young, flexible ones from around September here, which is in New York, and sometimes into January. Over the winter, bark, especially near the base of young, vulnerable trees, may be gnawed by rabbits, voles, and mice. Porcupines eat bark too, but can climb, so their damage may even be found high up in trees, not merely at the base. Next, though, I have to take a hard look at myself and how I figure into all this. Conversations with my trapper friend and with Marn Chichnell, a wildlife program specialist for Ohio State University, have helped keep me honest on this score. How can I expect wild animals to respect boundaries if I have put none in place, and in some cases have even issued an inadvertent invitation? Chichnell teaches a five-element toolbox for dealing with nuisance wildlife, from lethal methods, from snap, mouse traps, to deer hunting, to exclusion, a fence, or individual plant protectors, to the use of repellents or scare tactics, and maybe most important, habitat modification. The last one is where I need to ask myself, what am I willing to give up or to repair or modify to make my place less attractive? If woodchucks have chosen beneath the back porch the last 3 years as a nursery, perhaps it's time to repair that loose board and bury hardware cloth as you do so. Gardeners, being driven mad by squirrels or chipmunks, cannot blithely hang bird feeders and wonder why, and likewise feeding the cat on the back porch invites all manner of other dinner guests. Planting young fruit trees without protective collars, only to see most of them girdled the first winter by rabbits or voles, should really be no surprise. I live in black bear country and ask for trouble if I put out the trash the night before or otherwise pique curiosity with appealing smells of pet food, bird seed, or even the barbecue grill left uncleaned. Bottom line, to modify animal behavior, we must start by modifying our own. What level of pushback is really warranted? If the problem is merely occasional and not on edible crops, perhaps spray repellents blending putrescent egg or egg solids, rotten eggs, and capsaicin, hot pepper, will work. These products are not cheap and must be reapplied regularly. Fencing a vulnerable area like a vegetable garden, including bearing wired mesh, may solve your problem. Before you purchase a single trap, think very clearly. What do you plan to do if and when you catch something? Not only can it be stressful for the animal and for you, but not knowing safe handling of live traps is foolish and even dangerous. Plus, many localities forbid relocation of wild animals, in some cases even by state-licensed trappers, let alone homeowners, meaning you would have to exterminate the animal on your own property to obey the law. I cannot say enough how grateful I am to know an expert and considerate professional trapper, and I do trap in partnership with him when I have a woodchuck problem. I am able to trap them by the strictest humane guidelines he has taught me. He is licensed by the DEC to move the animals, and I hire him to do that. I always call before I set traps to ask if he will be in my area that day for a potential pickup, because I don't want an animal in a trap for an extended period. I check traps frequently throughout the day and never leave full traps in the sun. Also, if you are trapping for woodchuck, say you feed by day, close your traps at night so you may get a skunk or raccoon or even an opossum. One thing I heartily endorse that everyone do year round is keep after mice, who are the primary vector in my region, along with chipmunks, for transmitting the bacterium-causing diseases like Lyme to ticks, that ticks then transmit to us. At the same time, using the same tactics, I keep after the voles. I bait snap traps with peanut butter year-round for both rodents in all their respective hotspots. Though with voles, I use a large number of traps per area. Outdoors, I place traps inside wooden boxes with removable covers and a small entry hole in one side that I made from plywood to protect birds and other animals, a design modified from Elliot Coleman's vole boxes. Whatever the havoc, mothballs are not the answer and are highly toxic and illegal for garden use. I hear from readers whenever I mention animal control who share the tip that they've discovered mothballs and spread them in a vole-besieged bed or along their deer-pressured property line or even in a stone wall, perhaps to deter snakes. No. Any use not specifically listed on the package violates federal law and can harm you, pets, or outdoor animals, and contaminate soil and water. Mothballs and flakes contain either naphthalene or paradichlorobenzene and do not belong in garden, nor an attic, cellar, garage, car, or crawl space. And the next topic is tough love transplanting. Though container plants, the standard of the nursery industry, are easier to work with than field-dug, bald, and burlapped ones, and readily available, often they are root-bound and need a stern hand at transplant time to thrive. The most common mistake with trees and shrubs in particular is failing to tease apart, examine, and even correctively prune the root ball. Once unpotted, have a close look. Are the woody plants roots wrapped around in the shape of the container, perhaps circling, which can lead to deadly girdling roots, or maybe hook-like or knotted. What you are seeking is not a congested lump to stuff in a hole, but more an architecture like the spokes of a wheel headed out in various directions to anchor the plant. I cut off the worst of the mess to try to guide it in that direction. With pot-bound perennials, I pull apart the root mass or even score it with my pruners to loosen things up. Another transplanting error that leads to poor performance or even plant death is planting at the incorrect depth. A tomato can be delighted to be buried up to its neck because it has the ability to root all along its stem. But a tree or shrub buried too deep will not thrive. The old wisdom of digging a $10 hole for a $5 plant is now frowned upon and can contribute to the too low planting results as amendments we all once used, like peat moss formerly added to excavating soil before backfilling, are lightweight and eventually settle as the plant sinks into a sump. I am careful not to put anything unstable, like clumps of sod or unfinished compost, into the bottom of the hole. Regarding amendments in general, it is illogical and unhelpful to give the root ball, say, a foot of lightweight planting medium all the way around. Then once the roots get through it, have them confront the reality of the surrounding native soil. Better to let stimulation from the root pruning encourage them to be brave and explore their true home as soon as possible. I use my hands and also a stick, whether a half of a bamboo cane in a smallish hole or broom or shovel handle in larger holes, to prod around the edges and eliminate air pockets. I water slowly for a long period, usually with a donut-shaped sprinkler or low or with a length of soaker hose, with a jet of water like when washing the car. We have run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.